From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, today is Wednesday, September 8th, and this is In the Moment. Today, the Dakota Political Junkies are with us discussing the mask mandates across South Dakota's school districts. Political scientists Lisa Hager and David Wiltsey join us. The Nest Predator Bounty Program is the latest story from Bart Fancook from South Dakota News Watch. He's with us for a look into his reporter's notebook. We look into the U.S. Small Business Administration's National Business Week virtual summit with Jamie Wood, the South Dakota District Director. And we preview tonight's On Call with the Prairie Doc on SDPB-TV with Dr. Jill Cruz. And we're broadcasting live today from the Kirby Family Studio at SDPB in Sioux Falls. I'm Kara Hetland. You're in the moment. The news is first.
With SDPB News, I'm Kyle Ireland. The Rapid City Area School Board voted against a two-week mask mandate. It also decided against forming a committee with doctors who would make further COVID-19 safety recommendations. The measures, which failed 5-2, were proposed in response to rising cases within the district and the Black Hills. SDPB's Ariel Zients has more.
Tensions ran high before and during the school board meeting.
Children are sick, and you don't care.
Dozens on opposite sides of the mask issue chanted and sometimes yelled at each other during a demonstration before the vote. 70 people signed up for public comment, and security removed hecklers during the meeting, which was packed despite being held in a larger room than normal. Joanna Smith came to the protest with her husband and baby. She says parents, not the school board, should control masking.
If it makes parents feel safe, they should be able to have their kid wear a mask to school. And if it makes parents feel like it's hurting their child's learning or in some way negatively affecting their child, I think a parent should have that choice to be able to send their kid to school without a mask.
Cy Isler is a district parent and nurse at Monument Health. She says the hospital is short-staffed while dealing with 3 floors of COVID patients. That means long wait times for others.
It's hard on everyone across the board. If people would mask up for a while to help slow the spread, this would help the health care workers help everyone.
The school board heard from doctors who specialize in emergency medicine, intensive care, the immune system, and pediatrics. They say a mask mandate would help the situation at the hospital. One doctor, who specializes in physical rehab, spoke against masks for kids. I'm SDPB's Ariel Zients in Rapid City.
Avera Health will require full vaccinations for its physicians, employees, and volunteers by December 1st. The policy also applies to medical students on rotation in Avera facilities, contract workers, and vendors. Avera will consider exemptions for employees with medical problems and sincerely held religious beliefs. Employees who receive an exemption must wear personal protective equipment and comply with regular COVID-19 testing and other preventative measures. Avera is based in Sioux Falls. Another Sioux Falls health system, Sanford Health, already requires COVID vaccines for its employees. Sanford faced protests after announcing the mandate in July. The state's other major health system is Monument Health in Rapid City. It does not require vaccines for its workers. In today's weather, we have highs in the 80s in the west, 70s in the east, with lows in the 50s in the west and southeast, and 40s in the northeast. Widespread haze expected this afternoon in the west, otherwise sunny skies. Sunny skies and breezy conditions in the northeast, with some gust reaching as high as 23 miles an hour. And sunny skies and mostly calm winds in the southeast, with some gust potentially reaching 25 miles an hour. Going ahead to tonight, some widespread haze before midnight. Otherwise, mostly clear skies in the west, partly cloudy skies in the northeast, and mostly clear skies in the southeast. Going ahead to tomorrow, we're expecting highs in the 90s in the west, 70s in the east, with widespread haze and sunny skies in the west, and mostly sunny to pretty sunny skies in the east. For more news from SDPB, visit our website at sdpb.org/news. For listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Kyle Ireland.
And I'm Kara Hetland. Bart Fancook is content director and an investigative reporter with South Dakota News Watch. His latest story dives into the Nest Predator Bounty Program in South Dakota. He joins us today with a look into his reporter's notebook. Bart, thanks for being with us today.
You bet, Kara. Thanks for having me.
So let's just give me a brief summary of your article and what you're looking at with the bounty program.
Yeah, thank you. You know, few, if any, South Dakota wildlife management programs in recent years have resulted in such a clear and a strong division among policymakers, wildlife experts, and South Dakota hunters and residents. On a basic level, the program offers $10 bounties for the tail of each nest predator that's trapped and killed during a spring trapping season. In support, Governor Kristi Noem, who launched the program, GF&P Secretary Kevin Roebling, and a majority of the GF&P commissioners say the program is reaching its two main goals in its 3 years of existence, and those are to protect pheasant and duck eggs and chicks by, so far, trapping and killing about 135,000 raccoons, skunks, possums, and other predators during the past three spring seasons, while also encouraging children and young adults to take up trapping and embrace a more outdoorsy lifestyle. On the other side of the issue are some experts, wildlife managers, and members of the public, who say the $2.4 million spent on the program, about half for the bounty so far and half a million in an initial trap giveaway, would be better spent on pheasant habitat expansion. And some also say that luring children into trapping by offering a financial incentive is not really the best way to expand the state's outdoor heritage. And meanwhile, there's some residents who've come forward to label the program inhumane, cruel, and call it, you know, senselessly killing certain wild animals for the protection of a lucrative hunting industry.
It seemed in reading your article that you were really in search of the data. Did you find it?
Yeah, I think so. You know, one thing that I found was that overall pheasant count, which isn't an accurate measure and was stopped a couple of years ago, that the numbers have declined over the past decade or so, and so has the interest in the actual hunting of pheasants. And the state has seen a big decline I think 38% or so in the last 10 years of non-resident hunters. And that's where the state's the bulk of the state's or the majority of the state's $300 million pheasant hunting industry comes from. So there's a lot of evidence that, you know, the state is seeing its title as America's pheasant hunting capital wane a bit here in recent years. And, you know, policymakers and state officials are eager to return us to that glory and that position where residents of other states are eager to come here for our pheasant season, spend money on licenses, hotels, motels, food and drink, and really fuel an industry that affects a lot of businesses in South Dakota.
So, at the same time the bounty program began, the brood count stopped. So, how do we know how we're really doing with the pheasant population without doing some kind of brood count?
Well, that's a great question, and that's one of the problems here. And the biggest point made by opponents, Kara, is that, and acknowledged by supporters, is that while the program has seen an increase in trapping among South Dakota youth, there's no scientific method in place to track whether the program is boosting pheasant or duck populations or to measure any potential unexpected or unanticipated outcomes among wildlife and the environment. So between the brood count and the lack of any science applied to whether or not this is working or could have unexpected outcomes, that is a major talking point and a major arguing point for opponents of the program, especially those who have been in touch with South Dakota wildlife management for years, who have looked at this from a number of issues. They don't see this nest predator bounty program as a tested or scientifically proven method. And I did also look at a number of research articles, including some suggested by Secretary Roebling, that just don't come to the conclusion that these programs have been effective in the past. They can be effective in small areas during small periods of time where you're trying to really protect a small population of animals. But this, even though the vast majority of the animals killed have been East River, this is a statewide program. And so that's another point I think that people, some of those opponents would like to see modified or at least discussed in greater detail moving forward.
All right, Bart Van Cook, I really thank you for taking time. And, you know, Pheasant Opener is just around the corner as well in October, and we'll see if hunters come. So thank you much.
Thank you. Yeah, I just wanted to mention also South Dakota News Watch is hosting an online panel discussion on pheasant management and the predator program, 7:30 Central next Wednesday. You can get details at sdnewswatch.org.
Awesome. Bart Van Cook, thank you so much. We appreciate you being
with
us today.
Me.
After the break, Dr. Jill Cruz joins us ahead of tonight's On Call with the Prairie Doc on SDPB-TV.
Twenty years ago, the September 11th terrorist attacks changed the world. I'm reporter Jim O'Grady, and I'm going to revisit the evidence and question the people at the center of the story.
It's always easy in hindsight to say it's a big mistake.
Let's penetrate his cell.
And I promised him revenge.
Blind Spot, The Road to 9/11, an investigative special from the History Channel and WNYC Studios.
Listen Friday, September 10th at 1 Central, noon Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding provided by photographer Paul Horsted and his book, The Black Hills, Yesterday and Today. More than 100 then and now photographs revealing historic places from Custer to Deadwood and Mount Rushmore to the Badlands. More at paulhorsted.com.
Tim Lambert was listening to the radio on 9/11.
I heard that a plane had gone down in Somerset County, Pennsylvania.
His family owned land there. And when Tim's dad saw the images of where United 93 crashed, he told Tim,
I think those trees are ours.
20 years later, the story of that land and the people linked to it forever is still unfolding. Listen to Sacred Ground from NPR.
Listen Saturday morning at 10 Central, 9 Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding is provided by Sanford Underground Research Facility, supporting South Dakota teachers and students with classroom resources, field trips, and professional development. Learn more at sanfordlab.org.
Health reporting on SDPB is supported by Monument Health. This is In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Kara Hetland, and On Call with the Prairie Doc can be seen Thursday nights at 7 Central, 6 Mountain on SDPB. And tomorrow night's show is on nephrology, did I say that right, which focuses on the diagnosis and treatment of diseases of the kidney, and is hosted by Dr. Jill Cruz with the Avera Medical Group in Brookings. And she joins us now with a preview. Dr. Cruz, help me with my pronunciation.
You said it exactly right, nephrology.
Nephrology. So,
yep, or kidney doctor works too.
Kidney doc, there we go. So let's talk a little bit about what kind of symptoms takes a person to a nephrologist.
Usually symptoms would be anything relating to the kidneys. People see the nephrologist if they're having problems where their kidneys aren't working as well, if they're having problems with poorly controlled diabetes affecting the kidneys, and you can get what's called the diabetic nephropathy, which is basically damage to the kidneys from diabetes. A lot of times people have problems with like blood pressure issues or problems from chronic anemia related to the kidneys not producing enough of a hormone called erythropoietin that helps the bone marrow stimulate the bone marrow to create red blood cells and can lead to anemia if it's not properly treated. But a lot of times there isn't much for symptoms in early kidney disease. People really don't notice it. It's something that we pick up on kind of screening lab and tests that we do here in the clinic. So that's where having that relationship with your primary care doctor is always important, so we can find things before they have symptoms, because there can already be damage with early stages of kidney disease with really out much symptoms at all.
So is this, I mean, if I might think I'm having a problem, I would maybe go to a urologist before a nephrologist. Is that kind of where you'd think?
Deal more with the bladder,
yeah,
and with kidney stones, but Nephrologists are dealing specifically with the kidneys and how they create the urine. So if you're having problems with that. So, yeah, they're working in the same area, but completely different specialties with different areas. The urologists generally work with more like prostate issues if there's a blockage with the urine getting out of the body due to the prostate being enlarged. So that's more of what they work with, bladder cancers, frequent bladder infections. So one's dealing with the problem when it's lower in the body, and the other one's dealing with the problem up higher. So it's this whole urinary system, but it's so specialized that each part of the system gets their own specialist.
So you're really talking that you need to have these conversations with your primary doc so you can go to the right direction.
Exactly, because if I send you to, the wrong, sorry, that's not my area of specialty and I can't help you, and that can be kind of a wasted time because it can take a while to get into some of these specialists and definitely wasted money. So you want to make sure you're going to the right doctor for the right problem.
So talk a little bit more about kidney disease and some of those, when you as a primary doc is going to say, okay, now it's time to go. What kinds of things are you seeing?
So when I'm starting to watch the kidney numbers, the blood test where I'm looking at what's called the BUN, blood urea nitrogen, or the creatinine, those are two markers of kidney function. When I see those numbers start getting worse, that's kind of how we grade our level of kidney disorder. And if it starts to get to like a grade 3, then I say, we definitely need to get the kidney doctors involved because there's a stage from grade 1, slightly abnormal, to grade 5, needing to be on dialysis. So when you hit that 3, that's really where you get that sweet spot of, hey, we need to do something now, or we're going down a road that is talking about needing dialysis or possible kidney.
Dr. Cruz, I think we're having a little bit of technical problem. You keep cutting out just a little bit, and so so we're going to quickly call you back on another line. And
Good.
In the meantime, I'll do a quick little promo here that On Call with the Prairie Doc is seen Thursday nights at 7 Central, 6 Mountain on SDPB-TV. Tonight's show is on nephrology, which focuses on the diagnosis and the treatment of kidney diseases. And Dr. Jill Cruz is back with us again.
Hello.
There you go.
This is a
okay.
Better connection.
Much better connection. Thank you. I think we're just having some technical bumps there. Were talking about a blood test, a simple blood test, mm-hmm. and is that part of a regular annual panel test of blood work that's done?
That is in what we call a basic metabolic profile, and that's kind of a normal screening test that I do, especially if patients have high blood pressure. So we're checking kidney function because high blood pressure and damage to the kidneys can go hand in hand. So people with diabetes, people with high blood pressure, they all need to have their kidneys watched fairly closely to make sure that we're not having any worsening symptoms or developing symptoms.
What kind of calls do you think you're going to be expecting tonight tomorrow night on the program?
Well, I think we'll be talking about probably the limits from, dialysis, kidney replacement, organ donation, to how do I keep my kidneys protected against diabetes? How do I keep my kidneys protected against, damages from high blood pressure? I think it's going to be kind of a wide range of topics, and then kind of talk about some of the other things that kidneys do, their importance in affecting vitamin D levels, which is important for strong bones, and talking about, the kidneys level in managing blood pressure, and also talking about the kidneys' role with vitamin D and how we use and need that for strong and healthy bones. So there's a lot of things that the kidneys do that we can talk about, and I think it's going to be a very wide variety of topics that we can touch on. So it's going to be a fun show.
Awesome. Thank you, Dr. Cruz. I really want to thank you for being with us today. On Call with the Prairie Doc is in its 20th season, can be seen Thursday nights at 7 Central, 6 Mountain on SDPB-TV. And you can also find them online at prairiedoc.org or search Prairie Doc on Facebook. Thanks again for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Up next, the Dakota Political Junkies are with us to discuss the debate around mask mandates in South Dakota school districts. You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
From A Reckless Rover to Disco Godfather, a new archive of 20th century cinema celebrates the work of Black filmmakers.
There are just so many radical ideas and expression of Blackness in Black cinema's past that can really help shape Black cinema's future.
I'm Elsa Chang, the Black Film Archive, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Listen, beginning at 3 Central, 2 Mountain, on SDPB.
Program funding by Arts South Dakota. Arts South Dakota is offering opportunities for arts and humanities organizations to grow with federal funds from the American Rescue Plan. You can learn more at artssouthdakota.org/grants.
Duke Ellington gave Norris Turney the unenviable job of replacing the great Johnny Hodges in his orchestra after the legendary alto saxophonist died in 1969. Always a Hodges fan, Turney managed to carve out a niche for himself in the Ellington band by soloing on alto as well as flute. I'm Carl Gerke. Turney was born 100 years ago today, and this evening on Jazz Nightly, we'll hear a few of his recordings with Ellington. You can join me at 8 Central, 7 Mountain.
Program funding by Royal River Casino and Hotel in Flandreau. Pleased to sponsor Dakota Life, Greetings from Flandreau, on SDPB-TV and SDPB.org in September. Royal River Casino and Hotel in Flandreau. Take the crown.
Politics and Public Policy Reporting is supported by the Center for Western Studies at Augustana University. You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Kara Hetland, and school board meetings across the country have been erupting into shouting matches, and it's happening right here in South Dakota as well. It happened in Mitchell, also happened last night at a meeting of the Rapid City School Board. It was contentious before it even got started, and those champion either side of the debate about mask mandates are energized and loudly voicing their opinions and joining us with their opinions are the Dakota Political Junkies today. From the Janine Basinger Studio in Brookings, David Wiltsey is an associate professor of political science at South Dakota State University. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And Lisa Hager is an assistant professor of political science also at SDSU. Lisa, thanks also for being here.
Thanks. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. So let's start in and start talking a little bit about mask mandates around the state at schools and just the shouting that's going on.
Yeah, so I think we're seeing quite a bit of emotion regarding masks and really any sort of COVID-19 safety measures that could be put in place to hopefully curb the spread of the virus at this point. I know that the SDSU poll has been hard at work trying to gauge what South Dakotans' viewpoints are regarding all of these different sorts of mitigation strategies. And Dave, as the director of the poll, will definitely have some interesting information to share.
Well, Dave, let's talk a little bit. Let's stick with the politics of school boards for the moment, and then we'll get into the poll. But let's just talk real quick about just the politics around school boards being the ones forced to or wanting to make these decisions.
Yeah, in many ways, what we've seen is just kind of a shift of the political arena. Last year, both in the fall into the spring, so much of the anger, so much of the emotion was really playing out in city halls across the country, in town meetings and that sort of thing. We saw this across South Dakota. Brookings had some pretty interesting meetings on that. But as, you know, mandates citywide began to be repealed, as they expired, things just kind of shifted over to the schools. And the schools are just this nexus of so many interests. I mean, you have the interests of parents who, you know, have been really burdened by remote schooling and the like. You have just the normal politicization that's come from COVID playing out here as well. So it's just been just this perfect crucible for all of these things to burn in and really come out in explosive fashion at times. And South Dakota is not unique in this. This is something we've seen in state after state.
Do you see an ending? Do you see a solution? A resolution, maybe?
Not until we really get a handle on the pandemic itself, or we just completely normalize what we're living under right now, which is just tamping down breakouts here and there, and come to some kind of consensus on how we're going to handle it. But at the moment, I don't see any kind of consensus emerging.
And that takes us to your poll, and really, it's on the being vaccinated. So tell me a little bit more about it and what you learned.
Yeah, on this particular release, we have other behaviors in the poll that I can discuss a little bit. But the most important thing to take away so far from our data is how polarized we are on virtually every question of COVID, whether it's our probability of being vaccinated or our willingness to get vaccinated, get the booster shot. All of this really is coming down on some very stark partisan lines. And these lines were drawn pretty early in the rollout of the vaccinations. And we don't see a huge difference between the probabilities of Democrats and Republicans being vaccinated between now and in April, when we hit that 50% point of the South Dakota population of being vaccinated. We really have kind of lodged into a holding pattern in many regards to vaccination likelihood. The only group that we've seen change at all, and what looks like they might be persuaded by either public health campaigns or peer pressure, neighbors, or any other pressures that have been placed upon them, are independents. So we're seeing a little bit of movement, but overall, our vaccination rates are just slowly creeping up, and I don't really see that accelerating much in the near future, despite what's going on with Delta.
So the line has been drawn, and nothing's going to change their mind. Is that really what
you're
hearing? Not much.
Yeah, that really is what we're hearing.
Does that surprise you?
Not anymore. It did initially. In our April work, we asked very pointed questions like, do you know someone who's died of COVID in your family, friends, you know, what have you? And even amongst people who have had a close family member die, that has not influenced their behavior on vaccination or mitigation attitudes at all. I mean, it just has no effect. So it really has become thoroughly politicized. And with it, it's really a part of people's identity now, these attitudes they have on all these different mitigation methods and vaccination itself.
So take me, this survey was done July 31st through August 14th, correct, of this year?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
So fairly recent, Delta mm-hmm. was just starting to creep up.
Yeah, Delta was, you know, rising throughout much of the country before this, really starting to get into South Dakota at that point. So I think the rise of Delta probably won't have much of an effect on people's behaviors here.
So in the Mitchell Daily Republic this morning, Lisa, Senator Thune is quoted as saying, if you don't like the debate over a mask mandate, then get vaccinated.
Yeah, I saw that. I thought that was a very poignant take on what should be done in light of COVID-19 pandemic, especially the Delta variant. And I think that is something that you know, could definitely have an impact on individuals in the state, since Senator Thune is a well-respected Republican politician. And I think that's something that, you know, would become an interesting question moving forward for the SDSU poll, to see how these respected politicians coming out in favor of vaccination in a very strong way can influence people's decision making.
Yeah, and we've actually simulated this in surveys, and it really has no effect. And a lot of it is just because these attitudes were baked in so early in the pandemic. It became politicized so early that even though we're seeing more and more Republicans being very vocal about the importance of vaccinating, state after state after state, their constituencies just aren't—they're not responding to it. The attitudes are just so baked in and very hard to dislodge at this point.
So there's, I just have a hard time, you know, thinking that there's nothing that can be done.
Yeah, it's not to say that there's nothing that can be done. It's just, you know, to recognize the limits of it and to really try to find the tools policy-wise and public health-wise and how to really approach people that have these deep-seated fears or hesitations of being vaccinated. One thing that we have shown time and time again, both with our work here at SDSU and elsewhere, is that when you take a sledgehammer into a conversation about vaccination or mitigation or any such thing, people just don't listen. It just it further entrenches them into their pre-held beliefs. And the only way you can really crack into these communities is to make contact with others in those communities, use them as a messenger to really make a human connection with these folks, so they know it's coming from within. It's not coming from people outside the state, people outside of their faith, or any of these other things, but people who are close within those communities. That's where you're going to have some influence.
That trusted source, but that trusted source is different for every individual.
Exactly, and that's the challenge.
You said there were some other behaviors that you can discuss that haven't been released yet?
Yeah, I mean, we asked people to rank what they think are the most important mitigation practices, and we had them choose between things like wearing masks, vaccinations, eating vitamins, washing your hands. And on all of these questions, we saw very big differences between Democrats and Republicans. Republicans favored the things like washing your hands, eating vitamins, avoiding certain travel and that sort of thing, whereas Democrats very much prioritized vaccination and wearing masks.
Okay. So where do you see this debate going from here?
I think at this point, we're going to continue seeing debates more at the local level, like what we saw with the school boards. We are seeing, obviously, health being an issue that states generally deal with more anyway than the federal government. And we've seen that governors were really taking the lead. And based on what a governor's stance is, whether that is to, you know, allow mask mandates or not, for instance, or other sorts of COVID-19 mitigation tactics, that it ultimately leads these states and the localities in particular within these states to make decisions. So a lot of times school boards, for instance, you know, we see this playing out in Texas, you know, no mask mandates from Governor Abbott, but then a lot of school districts saying, no, we need these sorts of mask mandates in place in order to curb the spread of COVID-19. So I think we're going to continue to see these sorts of issues play out before more of the local governing bodies, more so than, you know, Congress or even a state legislature.
Can it go even just to the individual classroom teacher? Does it have to be a policy, I guess, is my question, from the school board encompassing all, or can it just be an individual school, a principal, a teacher saying, hey, let's just mask up?
Well, it's a classic collective action problem, where in order for any of these things to be effective, you need almost universal participation. Mm-hmm. And as soon as you start allowing individual people somewhere down the decision-making tree to make different decisions within the same population, it's just not going to be effective. And it's not great managerial practice either to have, say, different teachers in the same school having different policies, because then students and others can play off the teachers, and you lose the collective benefit of the policy. So it really does take coordination at a fairly high organizational level.
But if I, as an individual, just want to wear my mask around, I can.
You can, but the benefit from the mask is not to yourself, it's to the people around you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's I'm a college professor, and I walk into a classroom of 60 people, and if I were to wear a cloth mask, that's not so much a help to me. It might have some effect, but it's only when most or all of the people in that room are masked up that we really see the benefit of that that practice.
Okay. I want to thank you, both of you, for taking time and coming on the program today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks a lot.
David Wiltsy is an associate professor of political science at South Dakota State University, and Lisa Hagar is an assistant professor of political science at SDSU, joining us today from the Basinger studio in Brookings.
All right.
Let's take a moment now to honor another inductee into the South Dakota Hall of Fame. Walter Panzer is a theologian, police officer, paramedic, firefighter, and trustee. After the death of his grandmother, he became one of the trustees of the Leona M. and Harry B. Helmsley Charitable Trust. Panzer has spent a lot of time improving health care in rural areas using money from the trust. He appeared on In the Moment on August 24th, 2020.
When I was placed as a trustee, I thought to myself, wow, I could have a huge influence on many, many people and many lives and improve many lives. And I just thought it was an amazing opportunity, something I had to take. We looked at where could we make a lot of influence and make a lot of change, and where there was inequity. And that was the beginning of the rural healthcare program. And same with the diabetes program. My grandmother gave money to diabetes research, and we continued that legacy as well. A lot of continued training didn't happen here in South Dakota, or it was very difficult. And so we worked with the state and unveiled our SIMS truck. There's three of these in the state, where they travel to all the rural communities and train the EMS folks and train the critical access hospital employees on basically refresher trainings on different types of simulations, different types of cardiac conditions, things like that, with high fidelity human patient simulator mannequins that are like robotics. So that's key. Those type of things have saved so many lives and had such an impact, because you're bringing technology where to fill the gaps of our ruralness. I've been really proud of our rural healthcare program. It's been active for almost 10 years, about 10 years. And to date, we have given about $450 million out into seven upper Midwestern states. Just want to say we're not done here. There's so much more to be done to level the playing field when it comes to access to health in South Dakota.
The enshrinement ceremony for the South Dakota Hall of Fame Class of 2020 is taking place this Friday and Saturday at Owacoma. When we come back, we'll get details on next week's Small Business Virtual Summit from Jamie Wood, the South Dakota District Director for the U.S. Small Business Administration. You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
I'm Tanya Mosley. California Governor Gavin Newsom is in for a fight.
Larry Elder said food stamps, that's just a giveaway, but apparently cutting the corporate tax to zero, which he promotes, is not.
And his opponent is taking a page from the Trump playbook.
I'm also concerned about the way the left-wing media have characterized this. They call me the black face of white supremacy.
Next time on Here and Now.
This afternoon, beginning at 1 Central, Noon Mountain, on SDPB Radio.
Program funding is provided by First Dakota National Bank. Before First Dakota filed its charter in 1872, there wasn't a bank in South Dakota. What will be your South Dakota first? FirstDakota.com/first.
On the next Fresh Air, we remember Michael K. Williams, who died Monday. We'll listen back to our interviews with him. He co-starred in The Wire, Boardwalk Empire, The Night Of, and When They See Us, and is nominated for an Emmy for his performance in Lovecraft Country. Join us.
This afternoon at 2, One Mountain, on SDPB.
Program funding by the Center for Western Studies at Augustana University. Publisher of Bright, Clear Sky Over a Plain So Wide, a 56-year history of the Center for Western Studies. More at augie.edu/CWS.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Kara Hetland. This year's theme of the U.S. Small Business Administration's National Business Week Virtual Summit is Celebrating Resilience and Renewal. The theme spotlights the resilience of America's entrepreneurs and the renewal of the small business economy as they build back better from the economic crisis brought on by the pandemic. The Virtual Summit is next Monday through Wednesday, and Tuesday's session focuses on better serving small businesses and underserved communities. Jamie Wood is South Dakota's District Director for the U.S. Small Business Administration and joins us to share some details on the topic. Welcome back to In the Moment, Jamie. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Great. Thank you. Great to be here and excited about National Small Business Week coming soon.
So let's talk about this virtual summit. Tell me a little bit about how this works.
Yeah, this year is a bit unique. Of course, we're still, you know, climbing our way through and out of the remnants of the pandemic. And it has been challenging economically and also, you know, health-wise across the United States for millions. But we have been working diligently, the SBA, with small businesses and nonprofits across the nation for the better part of a year and a half to really get the resources, you know, in their hands that they need to sustain and survive. But believe it or not, a lot of businesses have still started and have grown, you know, during this time of distress. So it's been kind of interesting with the economy. But the Small Business Week, usually we have it in May, and it's usually held in person. But this, over the past, you know, year, we've really looked at it as an agency and just felt with so many businesses that have really struggled, and some of them have had to close their doors even, it wasn't really a good idea to just, you know, shine the light on those that are thriving. So we wanted to make it an event, a week-long event that everybody could participate in. And the only arena that we could get that done in is really in the virtual space. So we're having a virtual summit next week, and it's going to really showcase all of the many different pillars that SBA has to support small businesses. On Tuesday, one of those areas definitely is serving the underserved communities. And so those small businesses and underserved communities, when we're talking about that, we're really talking about minority-owned businesses, rural businesses, veteran-owned businesses, women-owned businesses. And so there are many sessions in the morning and the afternoon and even later in the day on Tuesday that really focus on some of these demographics.
So when you say minority-owned, underserved communities, it's not really a location, it's who the owner is?
Well, it can be a location or it can be the owner. So we do know that there's hurdles, for instance, in rural areas where rural-owned businesses are that could be of any demographic, and they face economic challenges just because of their geographic location. But there are also, you know, of course, our minority-owned businesses. Some of those are in big cities like Sioux Falls here in South Dakota or Rapid City. And then some of them are located in rural areas out on some of the tribal lands, for instance, across the state. And so we really are trying to focus as an agency across the United States and the territories that we serve to break down some of the barriers that exist for socially and economically challenged businesses and really help to professionalize and equalize these businesses in the market space.
And what are some of the tips that you're giving these underserved community small business owners? What are the top things that they really need to pay attention to?
Well, one of the major challenges that all businesses face, but for some businesses that do, face greater barriers because of where they're located or maybe if they're minority owned, you know, the access to capital is the biggest hurdle. So getting the operational funding in place to be able to either start a business or expand a business is always a challenge for every business owner, no matter who you are. So what we've really tried to do as an agency, and this is a constant challenge, but also opportunity for us to serve these businesses, is to really help them get ready, first of all, to be able to go to a lender and have a very strong business development plan available so that they can make the case and present their business as a lucrative investment for a lender. SBA partners with thousands of different lenders across the United States that provide everything from, you know, $500 loan all the way up to $5 million. So we have many different types of loan products that the government actually puts a guarantee on, and that helps also these small businesses to get to the yes at the lender table because it helps to take away some of the risk. So we do a lot of business development, you know, like preparedness with businesses. But in some cases, with some of our resource partners that we leverage, for instance, like SCORE is an organization we work with, a lot of times they'll actually go to the lender with the small business and try to help, you know, negotiate through the ask for that funding. We also have some training that's available in business development for getting federal contracts in place. So there's set-asides. Every year, the government set aside about 23% of their federal contracts across all of the different federal agencies, from Department of Defense to USDA to SBA, you name it, all of the agencies have to participate in this. And so these 23% of contracts are set aside for socially and economically disadvantaged small businesses. So Native American-owned businesses, for instance, women-owned, other minority-owned, service-disabled, veteran-owned, and some of the geographic areas like hub zone-owned businesses where that'd be a historically underutilized business zone that has special tax breaks and incentives. So we have many different types of training programs and resources small businesses can use to, you know, help their business to get ahead in the space. So our day-to-day operations really includes working with these businesses very closely to break down some of the barriers.
And is this summit mostly for established businesses or new startups or entrepreneurs or all of the above?
All of the above, definitely. This is a great time, especially since it's virtual. You can tune in and you can listen, and the presentations will also be available on demand after the event. But it's really nice because you can hear from experts from across the United States, not just, you know, coming out of D.C., but there's going to be panels that include business owners from all different types of backgrounds and locations that are really showing us how to successfully launch and grow a business. So there's something for everybody. For somebody who's wanting to just know how to start up a business, there's going to be some discussions and training and panels about that. And then also how to seek lending. Maybe you want to grow your business in exporting. There's going to be a special segment on how to get into exporting and even federal contracting. So those are really kind of the pillars that SBA looks at, is how do we, you know, help businesses to start and grow? And then there's also going to be some information on disaster recovery. We're obviously still in COVID-19, but we're also very active right now in helping many businesses to recover from natural disasters such as the drought. There's some drought emergency injury disaster loan resources that are available right now in South Dakota for about 32 counties so far. But across the rest of the United States, there's many areas getting hit hard by the hurricane season. And so all of that disaster funding and resources are provided, you know, throughout the year as needed. And so we have COVID and then more, you know, for disaster right now, too. So we'll talk about those as well.
Okay. So to register for the National Small Business Week Virtual Summit, you can visit sba.gov/NSBW. All events are live streamed. Jamie Wood is South Dakota District Director for the U.S. Small Business Administration. Thank you for today's preview. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Hill City is the only school in the nation that is allowed to use the legendary marketing symbol Smokey Bear as its mascot. SDPB's Nate Weck covers the sports and recreation beat. He recently took a trip to the Black Hills and visited Hill City. Nate, welcome back to In the Moment.
Hey, Kara, how's it going today?
It's good. How are you? So the Hill City Rangers, Smokey the Bear.
Yeah, it's pretty fascinating. You know, this is a story that kind of had on the radar for a little while, and it just worked with this trip to stop in Hill City, which obviously late August, early September is never a bad time to stop in Hill City. but it was one of those things where he was like, yeah, I think now's kind of the time to do this and explain to people why is Smokey Bear, why is Hill City allowed to use that imagery for its mascot? So we did chat with a few different people at the school, but Howard Shire kind of gave the best overall description of that kind of sets this story up. So I'll let him tell them and then we can discuss.
You go back to 1939 and had a wildfire start up and, you know, up north and west of Hill City. And, you know, the CCC was fighting it and the Forest Service, but a group of boys from Hill City, the basketball team led by Charles Hare from the board and some recent graduates, they went out to help fight the fire. And they were there every day. So subsequently, that led to the Forest Service, you know, saying, hey, you know, you can use Smokey the Bear as a mascot, Smokey Bear. And then we got the green and gold, which we didn't adopt those colors till later on.
Lots to unpack there, huh, Carol?
Yeah, lots to unpack there. So this is the Forest Service said, you can do this.
They did, yep. This was something that they used to kind of commemorate not just Hill City, but the community. And then at the time, if you notice, Howard Shire said at the time, you know, we didn't really adopt the green and gold until we got into the 70s. So they were the Eagles and it was blue and white kind of up until it got into the 70s. But prior to that, there was still Smokey Bear imagery and stuff like that around. It just took time until it got to about the mid 70s when they said, you know, let's change our mascot name to the Rangers and capitalize on this opportunity that we've been given to use Smokey Bear. And then Smokey Bear himself can be our image of our mascot that depicts the Rangers. So that's what we see today. And you might be asking, you know, well, if it was the basketball team that helped do this, you know, why are we talking about it during football season? Well, it's a good question. The real story behind that is they got brand new helmets this year, and there is a giant Smokey Bear on the side of it with a claw going through it, and it's super cool. The head
Smokey
coach
Smokey Bear isn't kind and soft and tender. He's really going at him, huh?
Yeah, it's kind of got that intimidation look to it with that three-dimensional claw marks going through it. It looks really sweet, and the helmets really have that North Dakota State type of look to them outside of the logo. It's very cool, and the team, I think, is the coach that's there too, and the coaching staff, you know, they do preach to their players about, you know, this is our story. We need to take pride in it and, remember the past, remember those kids from 80 plus years ago that went out and just helped do something because it was the right thing to do. You know, we go to battle every Friday, Saturday night during football season because it's what we're supposed to do. So they kind of use it a little bit of a motivational tool too. But I mean, the story itself, I mean, can you imagine even today? I don't think kids would even be allowed to go help with something like that. But, you know, definitely something cool. And then on top of it, Hill City is also the only school that is also given the honor of graduating at Mount Rushmore too. So they have all of these photos, panorama photos, when you walk into their school lobby that have every graduation photo of each class that got Mount Rushmore right there in the back as well. So they do take pride in that as well.
So they got permission in 1939, but they really didn't take advantage of that permission until the 70s. And so I'm wondering if the Forest Service has wanted to renege at all, or if there's been those conversations, or if they're just fully embracing it as the only school allowed.
Yeah, you know, that's a good question, and I haven't talked to anybody specifically with the Forest Service about it. I know that you know, their field as well is located on forest land, and that's something that when there's upgrades and stuff like that to be made, that's stuff that has to go through a little bit more of a process than just saying, ooh, we're going to have a school board meeting and decide to do this, because you have to also go to the Forest Service and get the same kind of permission. Because I know they did a few upgrades a couple years ago to some of their field amenities. But it's also, you know, I know that the community, what I can tell you, Kara, is I know the community is embracing it more today than they did, you know, back in 1939 up until the 70s. You know, there's even, you know, a giant wooden sculpture, the world's largest smoky bear, that right when you come into town on your way to the school. So, I mean, it's not just even a thing anymore when you get to the school and see it, but you see smoky bear imagery all over Hill City. And, you know, it makes it cool. It makes it kind of the talk of the town. And, yeah, they're really proud to tell their story and to get this out there because they think it's cool. And I thought it was pretty cool as well.
It is cool. And so in just the few seconds that's left, what surprised you most in your conversations with this story?
Well, I think what surprised me most is just how long it took to actually put Smokey Bear on the side of a football helmet before they've had just Rangers or HC, you know, something more standard. So just I think them finally deciding this year, why do we not have Smokey Bear on the side of our football helmets? We need to do that. And then to also add the nice touch of an intimidating claw going through it, I thought was cool too. So I think that's probably the most surprising part. But, you know, I think for people that, it's one of these stories that goes through school pride, and it's always exciting when you go to a community and people are excited about their town, excited about their school, and excited about the activities that go with it.
And you know just how much I love high school football. So thank you for painting this picture for us. And you have a blog online as well.
Yeah. Hey, thanks, Kara. Really appreciate it.